Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies titled My Personal Theological Journey, Believing and Its Tensions. Our speaker is Dr. Neil Gilman, Professor Emeritus of Jewish Philosophy at the Jewish Theological Seminary of America in New York. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Wiesel Center Director Michael Zank.
A native of Quebec City, Dr. Neil Gilman graduated from McGill University in 1954, was ordained at Jewish Theological Seminary in 1960, and received his PhD in philosophy from Columbia University in 1975. Dr. Gilman is the author of several books and essays, including Sacred Fragments, Recovering Theology for the Modern Jew, which was the winner of the 1991 National Jewish Book Award in Jewish Thought and was translated into Spanish and Portuguese, Conservative Judaism, A New Century, The Way into Encountering God in Judaism, Gabriel Marcel on Religious Knowledge, The Death of Death, Resurrection and Immortality in Jewish Thought, which was translated into Czech, The Jewish Approach to God, A Brief Introduction for Christians, and Traces of God, Seeing God in Torah, History, and Everyday Life. One of Dr. Gilman's essays, An Excursus on Eschatology, appeared in Etz Chaim, Torah and Commentary, edited by David Lieber in 2001. And his most recent book is Doing Jewish Theology, God, Torah, and Israel in Modern Judaism. In addition to having been a regular contributor to the Sabbath Week column in the Jewish Week, Dr. Gilman is also a member of Shema Advisory Committee and served on the Commission on the Philosophy of Conservative Judaism, which produced Emet ve'Emunah, the first statement of principles for conservative Judaism. A popular speaker and teacher, Dr. Gilman has served as scholar in residence in many conservative and reform congregations. In the summer of 2002, Dr. Gilman taught two courses on the philosophies of Mordechai Kaplan and Abraham Joshua Heschel at the Russian State University of the Humanities in Moscow on behalf of JTS Project Judaica. Dr. Gilman was the Aaron Rabinowitz and Simon H. Rifkind Professor of Jewish Philosophy at JTS. As of July 2009, Dr. Gilman is Professor Emeritus of Jewish Philosophy at JTS. Dr. Gilman was honored by Conservative Judaism magazine, who dedicated their fall-winter 2008-2009 issue to him in honor of his retirement. We are very pleased that Rabbi Gilman agreed to interrupt his well-deserved retirement and to join us in Boston tonight to speak on his personal theological journey under the heading of Believing and Its Tensions. Please welcome Professor Neil Gilman.
Thank you, Dr. Zank. It's particularly important that I should be here at Hillel because it was at Hillel, at McGill University, in 1953 that I gave my first public lecture on theology. Rabbi Samuel Kass, who was the Hillel director at McGill in those days, later will I tell you how I got to him, got to Hillel, but Rabbi Kass knew of my interest in theology, and he said, why don't you talk? And I said, because I don't know anything. But he said, that's okay. You'll do whatever you can do. You'll say whatever you can say. But I want to give you the opportunity to speak in public about theological issues. So I did. It was entitled The Jewish Concept of Man. I was a junior at McGill University in 59. That was my first public lecture. And I think it's interesting that tonight may be close to or really the last public lecture that I'm giving on Jewish theology at a different Hillel Foundation. And here at BU. In between, I lectured in many different synagogues departments of Jewish Studies, and of course, Hillel. And because of the fact that it was Hillel that gave me my first opportunity to speak publicly about my theology, I made it a practice that whenever I was invited to speak at Hillel, I went. And I told Hillel directors at all the conferences that I attended, if you want me, just speak, just ask, and I'll be there, because it was Hillel that made me a serious Jew back in the 50s. From 54 through today, I have been through various stages in an evolving Jewish theology. Part of it was my formal education. Part of it was the encounter with many serious Jewish thinkers. Part of it was books that I read, courses that I took. I just have to tell you that whenever I appear at a Hillel like this one, I have the fantasy that, as it was the case in 1953, when I was sitting back there in a Hillel lecture at McGill, and that lecture turned me on. The lecture then was delivered by Will Herberg, and I'll tell you how I got to hear Herberg. But it was there that I began to speak and to think seriously about Jewish theology. That comes later. But for now, let me speak a little bit about my childhood. This is the first stage in my Jewishness. It was spent in Quebec City. Otherwise, those of us who were born and raised there would call it Quebec. Quebec in those days was not a center of Jewish thinking or of Jewish anything. My mother was born in Quebec, strangely. My father came to Quebec to earn money so that he could go to Los Angeles. It was a route that many other Jews later followed from eastern Canada to L.A. And he was going to go to Los Angeles because he had a brother there, and that's where he was going to earn a living. But my father traveled from Nova Scotia to Quebec to earn enough money to pay his fare to Los Angeles. In the process, he met the woman who was to become his wife and my mother, and they remained in Quebec until 1972. I had long left Quebec in those days, but they stayed. I was born there, and I remained there, and I studied there all the way through until I left Quebec to go to McGill University in Montreal. And that was in 1950. Those of you who know Quebec probably visited it as a tourist. And it's a tourist haunt, I should say. It was also home to about 300,000 or 400,000 French Canadians, French speaking Canadians. 96% of Quebec was French. I like to say that 3% were English Protestants, and the remainder were about 100 Jewish families, of which my father and mother were one. My father, whom I later challenged as to why or not he decided to come to Quebec in the first place, didn't really tell me the truth. He was in Quebec because largely all the other Jews who were there in Quebec, it was a good business. arrangement. And they made a lot of money there. And I have to be grateful to my father for having done that. But it wasn't exactly a city in which Jews were to grow up. It wasn't a city where Jews were about ready to develop and to grow in their Jewish commitments and their serious Jewish. There were two other Jews in my class. My choice in those days was to go to a English-speaking Protestant school or a French-speaking Catholic school. I chose to attend the English-speaking Protestant school. There were about two or three other Jews who were in that class. Most of the English speakers went to this Protestant school. The others, and certainly the French speakers, went to the Catholic school. The Jewish community numbered about 100,000. And it was very, very small and very limited in its capacity. Most of the Jews over in Quebec were there because it was a good business town for them. And they sponsored one synagogue that was nominally Orthodox, but it was really much more, I would say, conservative. This was not exactly an exciting Jewish community. There was maybe one rabbi, maybe one cantor, chazan, shochet, all-purpose Hebrew school teacher, each of whom lasted 2 or 3 years and went on their merry way. I later asked my father why, since he was to become so interested in Jewishness, why it is that he stayed in Quebec. His answer was because my mother wanted to. That's not the whole truth. The whole truth was rather that it was a very useful place to earn a living. And that's where he established a home. The home was, I would say, moderately kosher. It was as kosher as they knew how to make it, and they didn't know very much how to make a kosher home. My father, in a very limited, superstitious way, wanted the house to be kosher. My mother didn't give a damn, but she did it for his sake, and because of him, I went to shul every Shabbos with him, and whatever kashrut and Jewishness we had in the house, Pesach, Hanukkah, you know, the usual basic limited associations with the Jewish tradition, we were able to follow that. But I had no interest, no vitality in continuing it. And I did it only really because I didn't know that I had a choice not to do it. I knew that it pleased my father, and so whatever he wanted me to do, that's when I did. Whatever Jewish education I had, and I'm speaking now very, very, you know, quickly, about 16 years. It's hard for me to realize now that the whole Quebec experience was a 16-year experience. No single other stage in my Jewish education lasted that long. But for 16 years, I was the only Jew in my English-speaking Protestant school. I played hockey on the street with a few English-speaking neighbors on the street. But that was it. Talmud Torah was basically whatever the teacher wanted us to know. In my case, it was basically what my father wanted me to know. That was to be able to read the Siddur, not to understand it, but simply to read it, to know the Hanukkah story, to know the Pesach story. And each year, we just repeated the same thing. There was absolutely nothing there that was worth remembering and worth striving to duplicate as soon as I left my father's hashgacha. It was basically a violation of every single educational principle that I later turned when I became a Jewish educator myself. There was nothing there that I was interested in pursuing or maintaining or continuing, which of course was why, as soon as I left Quebec and went to Montreal and was more or less on my own, the whole thing went out the window. No more kashrut, no more davening, no more tefillin, no more Shabbat. The anecdote that best typified those years was the day that my father called me and told me that a member of her family was going to have a bris and would I be able to go for the minyan. It was on a weekday morning, and not to forget to bring my tefillin. So I dug out my tefillin and tallis and went to my family event. And when I opened the tallis bag and the tefillin bag, I found an envelope. And inside the envelope was a $5 bill and a note from my father saying, I wonder how long it's going to take you to discover this. I called him back and I said, 2 years. He said, well, I have to tell you that that's good. And I'm glad that I'm glad that I asked you to go to this event, because that's why you at least got to see your talis and your tefillin. I think part of the picture was that I had a family of Orthodox Jews. I had a father. I had an uncle who was a rabbi, an Orthodox rabbi in Flatbush. And later, when I came to Brooklyn and to New York, to investigate what JTS was all about, I discovered that this man very much wanted me to go to an Orthodox school, rabbinical school, the yeshiva, YU, Yitzchak Elchanan Theological Academy. I have to tell you that I couldn't understand why in the world anybody would want to go there. But I spent Shabbat in that place because those relatives, and they were very, very pleasant to be with. I remember asking my cousin once, why do you do all of this stuff? He said, what stuff? I said, kosher stuff, Shabbos stuff, Pesach stuff. Why do you do all of that stuff? And he said, and I'll always remember that because I've brought it back many, many times. He said, because it's fun. And I said, it's fun? He said, yes, because it's fun. And it later occurred to me that by fun, he meant something relatively serious. It meant to him, don't look at theology, don't look at deep historical roots or any of this. Do it because it's pleasant and because it means something to us and to me. And at that time, that was about the worst reason in the world to get me to observe anything. Because of my stay in Flatbush, and when I began to suggest that I might be interested in going to yeshiva, my uncle asked me to meet Rabbi Soloveitchik. I said, "Who is Soloveitchik?" So he said, "Soloveitchik is a very, very great rabbi, thinker, professor, and he may be interested in having you continue your Jewish studies at yeshiva." So I went to see him, and it was an absolutely meaningless experience, because all he could tell me at that point was, "You don't know anything," which I knew. He says, "Don't come to yeshiva. We can't do anything for you here. Go back to Montreal, study Gemara for 5 years, and then come back and talk to us again, and we'll see what we can do." That was hardly the way to recruit me into rabbinical studies at Yeshiva University. Incidentally, and parenthetically, the next day I went to visit the seminary for the first time, and rabbis in Montreal, who very much wanted me to go to JTS, had called ahead to prepare the people at JTS to be nice to me when I visited there. I got there, and once I was sitting in the office of the Dean of Admissions, the phone rang, and then I was later told that was Dr. Finkelstein, who wants to talk to me. I said, "Who's Dr. Finkelstein?" So he said, "Dr. Finkelstein is the chancellor of the Jewish Theological Seminary. He's a very great scholar, and he runs this place and the movement." And I said, "Why does he want to speak to me?" He said, "Probably because the rabbis in Montreal called him and told him that he should court you." So I went in, and to show you the extent to which I didn't know what I was doing in those days, I was told, you know, just be honest with Dr. Finkelstein. Finkelstein asked me, in the course of this conversation, "Are you coming to JTS? So I said, honestly, I said, "I don't know. I said, I have an uncle who very much wants me to go to yeshiva." So he said, "So?" So I said, "Yesterday I went to see Rabbi Soloveitchik." So he said, "So what did Soloveitchik say?" Soloveitchik said, "If you don't come to the yeshiva, where will you go?" I said, "Well, tomorrow I'm going to visit JTS." So he said, "Don't go to JTS." I said, "Why not?" He said, "Because JTS, there's no serious Talmud Torah in JTS. So Finkelstein smiled, and he said, "Well, I'll tell you what Soloveitchik was saying. He was probably saying that from 3 o'clock in the morning till 5 o'clock in the morning, there is no serious Torah study at JTS. Until 3 o'clock in the morning, Professor Lieberman studies Talmud. He just has the office next door to me. He's a rabbinic scholar. And I'm always awake at 5, and I study from 5 o'clock on. So between 3 and 5, there is no serious Talmud Torah at the seminary." And that's probably what Rabbi Soloveitchik was suggesting, that this was a good reason why you should not go to JTS. So I smiled, and you know, this was all meaningless to me. I didn't know who Lieberman was, what Soloveitchik meant, what study to. I mean, the extent to which I was out of it is amazing. I must tell you, McGill was an incredibly great experience. There was no Jewish stuff to bother me. Remember that this was in the late in the 60s, and Jewish studies was no place in universities anywhere, and there's certainly nothing at McGill. I had nothing to do with the Jewish community at McGill. I have to tell you, Dr. Dank, that when my father brought me to Montreal to see McGill and to see dormitories, he said, "I'm taking you to Hillel House." So I said, "Why?" He says, "Because Hillel House is where the Jewish students at McGill congregate. This is where they have kosher meals. This is where they have Shabbat davening. This is where you're going to get lectures and classes. It's a very wonderful place for you to be in." So he wanted to take me to Hillel, and he was paying the bill, so he took me to Hillel. That was the only time I went to Hillel, until I met Judy. Judy, who is unfortunately no longer with us, was sitting next to me in Elizabethan poetry class. And whenever we had a chance before the professor came in, we would schmooze and talk about things, interesting things at McGill. And one day, she said to me, "Neil, what are you doing for lunch?" I have to tell you that my relationship with Judy was solely limited to the 2 or 3 minute conversations before the professor walked into class. I must have called her about a dozen times for a date. I got no place whatsoever. But here was Judy Greenblatt telling me, "What are you doing for lunch?" So I said, you know, in all of my most gallant reply, "Judy, whatever you're doing for lunch." So she said, "I'm going to Hillel." I said, "Why?" She said, "Because there's a lecture." I said, "Who was the lecture?" She said, "A Jewish thinker who just wrote a book." I said, "What was his name?" "Will Herberg." I said, "Who's Will Herberg?" She said, "Will Herberg just wrote a book called Judaism and Modern Man. It was very much influenced by Martin Buber and Franz Rosenzweig." I said, "Buber I've heard about, but who was Rosenzweig?" She says, you'll find out. Come to the lecture, you'll find out." So I said, "Well, if you're going to the lecture, I'll be very happy to go to the lecture." So she said, "Come." So we went to the lecture. And I have to tell you that if there were significant moments in my life experience, this was the first one. Herberg, at that time, was a disciple of Buber. I had not known in those days that he had been a Marxist, active in the American labor movement, totally unschooled Jewishly. But after there was a treaty between the Nazis and some Protestant thinkers, he broke with the church, and he became serious in investigating his Jewishness. As I have to tell you that at that time, I was beginning to be interested in Buber, because Buber was being taught in this Protestant Department of Religious Studies at McGill, and I was intrigued by the existentialist stuff. But Herberg made me convinced that Buber was not basically a Christian thinker, but, not at my knowledge, a serious Jewish theologian. And Herberg's lecture that day just threw me for a loop. It was the first time I had heard anything about Jewish thinking seriously discussed by a Jewish theologian and philosopher. And I said to him, I said to Herberg, "Why are you here So Herbert said, look, I'm 41 years old. I have had no serious Jewish education until a year or two ago. I then began to read Jewish thinking, and I read Buber, and I became intrigued by Buber, and I became a Jewish theologian in those days because of Buber's influence. And I said to him, that's where I am. He said, okay, so let's go out and have a beer. So we went out and we had a beer, and for 3 days I tagged along Will Herberg as he lectured all over Montreal in various universities, classes, and in synagogues. And at each of these lectures, as he talked about his book, I began to realize that there was something here in this Jewish stuff that I had never heard of. That all the Jewish learning that I had ever heard of was what the silly sermons and teachings that I had in Quebec by a bunch of, you know, rabbis, Orthodox teachers. I never got the date with Judy. But I have to tell you that that moment changed my life, because it was from that day on that I was able to say to myself honestly that I want Jewishness to be serious. I want to study. I want to learn a lot more than I have ever had before. And I see that it's something worth thinking about. I had never heard that anybody spoke seriously about Jewish thinking. So I went to the seminary for the first time. I studied. I walked into Finkelstein's office. That's where I had that famous encounter with the discussion about Soloveitchik. Finkelstein basically convinced me that if I'm really serious about catching up on my Jewish studies, come here. So that's where I was going to go. I have to tell you that in 1954, when I began my Jewish studies at JTS, the next 6 years were the most exciting, exhilarating learning experience I have ever had before. The first day I walked into the learning experience, the first day I walked into the morning Shacharit Minyan, and I looked at the first two or three rows, I said, oh my God, they're all here. Everybody who was anybody in the field of Jewish studies was sitting in that first row. That's where Finkelstein was, that's where Louis Ginzburg was, that's where Heschel was, that's where Kaplan was, that's where Sholem Spiegel was. They were all there. And the next day, I began what I would later recognize as six absolutely glowing years of learning. My mother resented this completely. She says, I don't want to have a son who's going to be a rabbi. And she said, I am not going to be a rabbi as your son. I'm going to be a rabbi as myself. But besides that, I have no intention of becoming a rabbi. I just want to study. And my father, of course, was absolutely exhilarated. And that's where my serious learning began. Well, I joined the faculty in 1960, and I stayed as a member of the faculty of JTS until I retired in 1985-1990. It was a long career, and I have to say that for various reasons, I think I left at a good time. I was at JTS during the heyday of Jewish scholarship. By the time I left, it was not commonplace to have Jewish departments all around the American university scene, which is what we have today. I gobbled up everything that the seminary had to give me. And fortunately, for me at least, seminary didn't teach me theology. Whatever theology I had, I brought in with me or picked up on my own. And that's how I began to teach. That the central factor in the history of the Jewish people was the communal experience. Judaism was the creation of the Jewish people. It was a centrality of peoplehood. Revelation was the discovery of what Jewish people attributed to Torah and to God in every generation. And the authority for what constituted Torah, the authority for what constituted halacha and theology was ab initio. The authority lay in the community itself. There was no independent outside authority than that of the community in generation after generation. So that's what I began to teach. And I have to tell you that two things. One thing was that my classes became a wrestling match, that I learned how to teach by presenting a position and laying it out at the outset for my students to challenge, and that the exciting thing about teaching theology in a school in which nobody else was teaching theology was that it made it possible for me to get through the barrier of what students came to school believing and what they could then go out and teach and preach. Nobody had ever done that for me. I navigated through my own rabbinical school experience without any serious encounter of a Jewish theology. I learned an enormous amount at JTS, but it was not anything about basic theological concepts. It was not about God. It was not about revelation. It was not about redemption. It was not about, sin. It was not about any of the things that I felt rabbis have to be able to talk about. Nobody ever taught me that. But I felt that I had the responsibility to teach that to rabbinical students. The second thing that I learned was that the best, most interesting classes were the wrestling matches. And to this day, I'm aware of the fact that many of the rabbinical students never came near to a class of mine because they didn't want the wrestling match. I don't know to what extent I had the effect of teaching rabbinical students to think seriously about what Jews should believe. I don't know how many of you, some did, but many, many did not. And those that did not, I think, were scared. And those that did not were just abandoned me and let me be. And that was okay. I didn't bother that. That meant, of course, that I had to acknowledge that my own thinking as a Jew was going to change and was going to evolve and was going to go in many different directions and that sometimes it was to more serious and sometimes less serious, sometimes more passionately devoted to the past, sometimes much more radically devoted to the future. It allowed me also to be able to confront Kaplan and to say where I think that everything he was doing was inadequate. He was not happy to hear that, but it was okay. I did it. The one thing that was required of me was that every time I tried to shape or to reshape a pattern of Jewish belief, I took it seriously. This was not to be taken lightly. It was to be taken seriously. And it was finally, therefore, to be a response to my life experience and the historical experience of the Jewish people from generation to generation. And then, to my dismay, along came cancer. Two independent bouts with cancer. Cancer of the jaw and of lymphoma. Intense Jewish treatment, and fortunately I had retired from the seminary a year before this occurred, and at that point I wasn't teaching actively anymore. I was lecturing around and I was doing other things, but no more JTS teaching. And for 3 years, I was either under radiotherapy, I was under medication, I was in treatment, basically. And as you can see, I'm still on the road. But even though I am very pleased to say that I am totally in remission from two bouts with cancer, I must say that even though that remains the case, the net effect of having struggled with this, with two bouts of this disease, had to affect my theology. If I really believed that theology has to evolve in through the encounter with life experience by the individual and by the community as a whole. But what fit into this place now was another thinker who had influenced me as much as Kaplan and Herberg had done earlier years. I began to talk a little bit about what my beliefs were, and a colleague of mine said to me, "Have you ever read Geertz?" I said, "Who is Geertz?" "Clifford Geertz," he said, "is an anthropologist who has said some very interesting things about culture." The book that had the most influence was a book entitled The Interpretation of Cultures, which was an anthology of his writings. And in that anthology, there was one paper called Religion as a Cultural System. Now, religion as a cultural system, as you probably should understand this, is the use of culture in an academic sense. Culture in that sense does not refer simply to Boston Symphony Orchestra or museums or stuff like that. Culture is the ensemble of beliefs and practices that define a civilization. And it was this thesis that suggested that religion is part of the synthesis of beliefs and practices that define a unique civilization. In my own thinking, the attempt to view what modern medicine can do and what I have been able to do in my own personal life experience is to try to establish a certain sense of order despite the chaos that cancer has brought into my life. I've often reflected on the fact that I was never seriously ill until I hit my late 70s. And suddenly, out of no place, I got two separate episodes of cancer. And suddenly, I discovered that not only that, but that my ability or my luck to have been in New York, in Manhattan, to have a hospital such as Sloan Kettering to go to, and to find myself now, 3 years later, in a state of remission, but that the remission is very much not complete. The good thing, the remission piece of it, the cosmos piece of it, is that I am free from cancer. The chaos piece of it is this. And the chaos piece of it, apart from this, is the obvious impact, which you've been able to recognize here tonight, of the medications and the treatments that have affected my memory, my speech, my ability to think, and has forced me into a struggle, constant struggle, with public lectures, with reading, with thinking, with writing. Nobody can do this for me. Books can do it for me. I can also say that there is no schedule. It's not as if I say that, well, in 2 years and 3 years and 6 months, whatever it is, if I do this, if I do that, a lot of therapy, physical therapy, psychological therapy, if I do a lot of these things, I can submerge the chaotic element that cancer has represented in my life. That I can't schedule. At the beginning, I had felt that my entire struggle with the chaotic factor represented by cancer demonstrated the extent to which an ordered world is very difficult to catch. I have now begun to realize that, in fact, much of it can take place if I'm lucky. The lucky part of it is the fact that I have had cancers that are treatable and even curable. That didn't have to be. As chaotic an element as the cancers that I did get, I could have gotten other cancers which would not have been subject to treatment. Fortunately, the cancers that I did get were treatable, and I was able to impose a certain degree of control. But I'm aware of the fact that I am 81 years old, that I don't know how late I can become, how long this can continue. And that's why I was particularly intrigued when Dr. Denk called me and said, "You want to talk about theology, about religion?" I said to myself, this is my opportunity to try to put together my evolution of how I went from my earliest years in Quebec, you know, to where I am now in 81, and to think about the fact that there are certain people and certain books certain anecdotes, certain statements that were decisive turning points in my thinking, and that, to me at least, theology was not something that, you know, you could just skip through it. That for me, it was everything. And I took it seriously. And since I took it seriously, I was basically subject to much of the give and take, and the ups and the downs, and the tension between the good days and the bad days. And so when I'm asked to speak about this at Hill House at BU, I say that this is an opportunity to see where I am. And I'm halfway in between. I am not completely comfortable with my current theological or religious or halachic stance. Not at all completely comfortable, but at least I'm taking it seriously. And this, I think, is the only thing that God demands of me. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Dr. Neil Gilman, Professor Emeritus of Jewish Philosophy at the Jewish Theological Seminary of America in New York. Dr. Gilman's lecture was titled, My Personal Theological Journey, Believing and Its Tensions, and was presented by the Boston University Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies. Tonight's moderator was Wiesel Center Director Michael Zank. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Paul Kahlo. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.